This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Maker Movement is taking hold in Vermont. That's a somewhat odd name that captures technology, design, innovation, and a strong DIY spirit. Around our region, communities of makers are using high-tech tools to solve problems, create art, and start a conversation about technology in our lives. At one makerspace in Burlington called Generator, machinery of all kinds are available for use: a 3D printer, a laser cutter, a metal shop, and an electronics studio. A handful of people were at work on different projects when we visited, and we asked two of its champions to explain what the Maker Movement is all about. Ken Howell is a professor of emerging media at Champlain College, and John Cohn is an engineer at IBM. Together, they preach the maker gospel of collaboration and of upending the traditional rules of design and manufacturing.
What the internet was for information, makerspaces have the potential to be for making and manufacturing. This enormous enabler that allows people really without maybe typical backgrounds in a particular area to make things themselves. What we've done for so long is we have this idea in mind and then we set about to execute it, and we only know at the end whether or not it was a good idea in the first place. But makerspaces are really about trying to get to that first prototype of something as quickly as possible and just playing with the material and letting it guide you as much as you guide it, deciding where you should go next and what you should ultimately make out of it.
Even making mistakes. You know, we teach people to enjoy their mistakes and learn from those.
I guess that's not supposed to go through your table.
That was a disaster.
Sometimes hear maker, you think, you know, hardcore geek and engineer, and it's really much more of a fusion of art and crafts and that science component. So it's much more balanced. There's a very collaborative spirit.
You're thinking about a project one way, and then you have somebody else come over and say, hey, did you think about doing this, or did you think about doing that? Things that you never would have occurred to you because you sort of had this one discipline.
That diversity of thought is really part of the maker thing, and you got to have a diverse group of people. And that can be gender, it can be disciplines, it can be, you know, backgrounds, ages, etc.
We're always trying to make our students as future-proof as possible. And one of the ways we do that is to teach them, you know, adaptability and being able to really problem-solve, critical thinking, creative thinking. And that's really what makerspaces do. It's about thinking with your hands and working through ideas. And those are exactly the same skills that we think the 21st century is going to require.
Here we go!
We were hearing Ken Howell and John Cohn there, who are involved with one of the maker spaces in Burlington called Generator. These spaces and the movement itself are growing across our region. And we're going to take a look today at who makers are and the potential the maker movement has to help us rethink technology. I'm joined now in the studio by Doug Webster, founder of the Champlain Maker Faire and CMF Incorporated. That's a nonprofit that promotes innovation, education, and scientific research. He's also a technical education consultant for the Vermont Agency of Education. Doug, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jen Carson is the founder of Vermont Makers. She's an artist, producer, and an instructor at the University of Vermont Fab Lab. And she joins us today as well. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. We've been hearing from a lot of makers around the state and around the region telling us about what their makerspaces look like and what they're working on. You can join the crowd. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So, Jen, Doug, anything to add there to what we were hearing from Ken and John about what the maker movement is? I mean, for people who are saying, I'm sorry, maker movement? You do make things? How would you describe it, Jen?
Well, one of the things that Ken was saying was about, you know, thinking with your hands. So it's really about getting in there, using new technologies, getting comfortable with those technologies and making things. And also I would like was emphasized earlier, is that collaborative spirit is really huge. So, and the accessibility as well. Really wanting, you know, I think a lot of us feel a lot of anxiety about staying on top of technology or being caught up. This is a moment to pause, to think about it, and to consider even being a maker or at least a critical consumer of technology.
Doug, why is technology so important in this? Why is that the critical piece here?
Well, I think it's important because we have all kinds of emerging technologies out there. The Arduino, the microprocessor, which is like the brains for most of the different devices that come out of the maker movement. They're very low cost. The same thing was probably in the hundreds of dollars years ago. You're talking $15 to $30 these days. As well, the manufacturability has gone through the gone crazy here. You're able to produce something at a very low cost with the 3D printers and laser cutters, vinyl cutters, all the different automated cutting and forming devices that are out there today.
And when we hear about a place like Generator, this maker space in Burlington, part of the idea is that you're making this kind of technology accessible to people. I mean, many of us have heard about 3D printers, but I certainly haven't had my hands on one, and I don't have any plans to buy one for myself. But if you become a member at a place like Generator, you can use that technology and create things yourself. Is that part of the idea
yes.
here? Of what Jen was talking about with collaboration, sort of being able to have access to the cutting edge technology.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. And you know, if you go back 10, maybe even 5 years, and for quite a while back, the equipment and the capability was tens of thousands of dollars to have a machine shop available to, at your disposal. And on top of that, you don't have a place. There's never been a place where you could use all the different types of equipment. Here at the Generator Makerspace and other makerspaces, you have access to a variety of equipment. And there really is no other place where you have all that, all those tools in one spot.
Yeah. Jen, Doug mentioned just briefly the Arduino, the microcontroller, microprocessor. Can you talk a little bit about what that actually is and why it's so crucial?
Sure. And it actually was my introduction to the maker movement when I was receiving an MFA in design and technology at the San Francisco Art Institute. I was studying sound installation and at the end was introduced to the Arduino as a way of being able to control inputs and outputs. For example, a sensor could be triggered and then that would trigger a sound. And so it gives you access to this brain that you can program using very accessible coding languages that are very bare bones and were made for education and also for artists as well. So there's this accessibility. Plus, the Arduino is open source, meaning that there's Arduino who makes the Arduino, but they've opened it up so that companies like SparkFun and other companies all around the world can produce this as well. Again, keeping the cost down and sharing the knowledge.
But what does it look like? So am I just using a computer and I find a program, or is it a special standalone piece of equipment?
Sure. So it's a circuit board, basically, that plugs into your computer. And then you have an interface on your computer that's really easy to use where you would input the code. And then that code is downloaded onto the circuit board.
And describe something that you would do with it. So something that I can have concrete in my mind of what we're doing with the Arduino.
Well, this is why it's caught on so much, is you can do just about anything. And for example, so my introduction to it was through creating art installations. So these would be experiences, creating sound experiences within a gallery or an outdoor setting. But it's used in robotics. It's used. There's one of the projects online that you can find was actually this guy had these two cats and one of the cats was sick. And so they had to be on different diets. So he created with an Arduino this system where the cats had different collars and it would trigger their food box to open up so that they couldn't eat each other's food. So it's endless. And it's used the engineering students at the University of Vermont are using this in prototyping in their senior design projects. So it's this huge community of people using it to do all sorts of different things, but they still can share knowledge around how to use the Arduino, which is really how Vermont Makers came together here in Vermont.
Because as you said, it is open source technology, so people can share what they're doing and work together to figure out how to make all of these pieces work.
That's right. And there's so much to learn from. There's an online community, but also being around other people. And in Vermont Makers right away, it was that there were artists and engineers locally who were starting to experiment with it. And here was an opportunity to bring people together in the same room, not necessarily just online, to be able to share that information. And it's one of those things you can never know everything, right? So it's just this, it just feeds your curiosity to be around other people.
I have comment.
Yeah, Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, this week at Shelburne Farms Coach Barn, we're running a camp for 10 to 18-year-olds. And the title of the camp is Arduino versus Arduino. We threw in the art there.
Yeah, Arduino, we should just, for people who are listening, it's A-R-D-U-I-N-O, right?
Yes.
That's
okay,
correct.
And so, Doug, the camp is Arduino.
Arduino. So, yes, what we're doing is merging art and science, technology all together. So what you'll see down there are, you know, kids of all ages in that range working with robots, working with Arduinos, working with they're Raspberry Pis, and they're actually wiring.
Actual Raspberry Pis? We're not talking
actual.
About a technology we're here, right? We're talking about Raspberry Pis?
Well, trying to get clarified, there's all kinds of different microprocessors out there, and they're coming up with these crazy names.
Got
that's,
it, okay.
That's one of them.
So. Well, you never know. At Shelburne Farms, it could be either one.
Exactly. Yes. So they're actually wiring hoodies and putting LEDs throughout the hoodies, and they have motion sensors and, you know, sound sensors and all that throughout the whole thing. And the whole idea behind that project is to get music and dance and all that together on the stage so they can really do a number on a show. So tomorrow afternoon at 2:30, there is a demonstration of all the different projects that kids have put together this week. But we're really trying to emphasize the integration of art and science together.
Yeah. So to pick up from there and tell me about, both of you can tell me about a couple of other cool projects that you know of that people have been working on. As we're talking today about makers and the maker movement, and there are all these different kinds of things that people are doing with it. So, Doug, what do you think? You know, with the cat collars is such an interesting way to think about one project that has a use. What else are you hearing and thinking about?
Well, there certainly are other, there's all kinds of applications out there for Arduino. One of the things that came up was in the agriculture industry, you have automated irrigation systems. There's on the national level, there's a electric skateboard. It has a wheel right in the middle of it, and you can skate all day on those things. So, of course, my own personal project is I play Highland pipes, and what we're doing with Jim Rita is putting sensors on the chanter, and then we're turning that into a tone generator, doing this wirelessly, and then that tone generate fiddle sound.
Ah, so you'll be playing the Highland pipes, but you'll be generating fiddle sound, so you'll basically have your own accompaniment.
I'll have it. Yes, exactly. And, you know, you can ask fiddlers, you know, it wasn't the last time you played with a bagpiper, and most of them will say, never, and I never will.
So you're creating your own community there.
I am.
Jen, any other cool projects that you've been hearing about or have witnessed?
As far as Arduino projects or just generally?
Anything. Expand. The world is our oyster here.
Okay. So, well, there has been this project going on this summer called Vermont Makers and Libraries Spark a Culture of Innovation, which was funded by the Vermont Community Foundation with support from the University of Vermont. And then we had a bunch of players come on board who are showing leadership, and that includes the Craftsbury Public Library, the Vermont State Department of Libraries, Champlain Maker Faire, that's Doug over here, and the Vermont Library Association, and this is to bring programs, five different, what we're calling STEAM, so that's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math programs, to 15 different libraries, 28 programs total. And that's starting to wind down right now. There's still a few left. But we've had these fantastic experiences in Vermont public libraries, bringing hands-on programming, staying away to some extent from kits because they even though the costs are low, they are more expensive, but doing things like one of our programs is a toy hacking. So it's a reverse engineering program that we can do by just purchasing toys at garage sales and things like that. Another one is squishy circuits, working with conductive Play-Doh and teaching basics around circuits. Another one was e-origami, which was teaching how to build structures out of paper that also use create circuits in them using conductive tape and LEDs. So we really tried to work the Vermontiness factor within that, which is what I always call it when we're trying to think like thinking about the material culture here in Vermont and how we can translate this idea of hands-on making, collaboration, art, and engineering.
We're talking today about the maker movement. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to hear from many of you who have thoughts about this, who have some experience, who want to share what you're doing in your area. You can post your comments online. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition, or call 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Marie, who's the librarian in Warren, and says, the libraries of Vermont are integral to the maker movement here, something we were just hearing about from Jen. Marie says, libraries across the state offer maker programs. Some are creating or have already created maker spaces. At the Warren Public Library, we circulate maker kits. So far, they have been low tech, learn to knit, learn calligraphy, friendship bracelet tying and beading. But in the fall, we'll be circulating a beginner electronics kit. And hopefully our Arduino and Makey Makey makerspaces don't have to be just about 3D printers and CNC routers. By giving our patrons access to these beginner tools, they can create their own kitchen table makerspaces. So again, more on makers, the maker movement, and makerspaces coming up here on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We are talking about makers today, innovators, creators, and do-it-yourselfers who are using high-tech tools and community knowledge to start businesses or just make cool stuff. Colin Bromstead is doing both. His business is called Charged Innovations, which he describes as making really cool on-off projects that light up and make noise. When our producer met him at Generator in Burlington, he showed off a project that he put together one recent evening. It's a MIDI Tesla coil. It's a foot-tall copper tube with a metal halo that plays music as it shoots purple sparks at 300,000 volts.
It doesn't really accomplish anything. It was one of Nikola Tesla's inventions. He was trying to transmit energy through the air. Takes a music file from a computer, works its magic with it, and then creates about a 1.5 foot spark. And the bzzz sound that you associate with the spark, it takes the music file and changes the frequency of the spark. That's what you're hearing, is actually there's no speakers. It's the spark and the exploding air that's changing frequency, and that's what you hear is music.
That was Colin Bromstead at Generator, a makerspace in Burlington. And in case you didn't catch it, his MIDI Tesla coil was playing a song by Offspring called Why Don't You Get a Job? We have photos and other projects at Generator online at vpr.net if you want to have a look at them. And I mentioned that Generator is what's called a makerspace. Today we're talking about the maker movement with Jen Carson, founder of Vermont Makers. She's an artist, producer, and instructor at the University of Vermont Fab Lab. And we're also speaking with Doug Webster, founder of the Champlain Maker Faire and CMF Incorporated, a nonprofit that promotes innovation, education, and scientific research. And we've heard from some of you this morning online, and we're hearing from more of you now. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your experiences on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Alex, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Hey there. How are you?
Great.
So my experience with the maker movement is not making things at all, but the idea of a collaborative workspace and this dynamic environment of shared resources can apply to many different fields. And I'm starting to see things in the nonprofit world, which is where I function, where people get together, for-profit, nonprofit, and they work in the same space. And I think a lot of that inspiration came from this incredible makers movement. So it's not exactly making anything, but it's the same concepts that have really been creating some innovation.
Alex, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. Great perspective there. Let's go to Nick calling in from Westminster and get another thought in here. Hi, Nick.
Sorry, I'm wearing a face mask. hi. I was just listening yesterday, and it dawned on me that the skill set needed to build things. I mean, you just can't just walk into a place and build things, you know? I mean, like, I make guitars, I make furniture, and I do it because the things that are within the realm of my financial ability are you know, unattainable. I can't get the fine instrument that I want because I can't afford it, so I had to build one.
Okay.
Then I started building them for other people. But in that, I had to learn so many skills I had to learn to weld, to build some of the tools that are necessary. Of course, I had to learn fine joinery and all about, you know, sonic response of instruments and the acoustic qualities of wood and about trees and, I mean, and sound and frequency, and there's just so much to know, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of just any old buddy walking into a, you know, into a shop full of stuff, it's beyond me, but I'm sure it's working, and I'm happy that it is.
Nick, thanks for your comments. I appreciate what you're saying, and I hear them. And it, you know, it's interesting to think about all of the things that you learn by making an instrument, all of the other different kinds of pieces of that that you touch upon when you're learning how to make an instrument for you then to play. What Nick was saying, too, is partly, you know, people just walk in and they make things, and, you know, how does that work? And I see here our guests, Doug Webster and Jen Carson, are, like, champing at the bit to jump in there. Jen was raising her finger like, wait! So go ahead.
Well, no, actually, what Nick sort of spelled out are two things that we really emphasize in the class I teach, Vermont Fab Lab Workshop at UVM, which is that he was motivated by solving his own problem. And the other thing he did is that he followed a personal line of inquiry, and it brought him, it sounds like, to some really unexpected places, but he was highly motivated. And that is, I think, the core of the spirit. And then you have these spaces where you can go and you that can play out, and you can meet other people who might be working on totally different things, but you can still, you know, gain knowledge from them. But it, and he also does make a really good point. I mean, there needs to be, I think, that personal motivation, but also education is, I think, more important than the equipment.
Doug, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. One of the things we stress at the makerspaces, in the emerging makerspaces, is that you have to have some type of qualification system in place before you can actually operate the equipment by yourself.
So you can't just walk in off the street and start working on the 3D printer.
No, and our insurance folks wouldn't like that either, I'm sure. we are working on what we call a skill badge system for people that are going into makerspaces and utilizing the equipment. Typically, in the badge system and industry recognized credentials, you know, usually they're at it much longer than a weekend or a week for that matter. But I think in the makerspace environment, the tools are automated as such that you can actually accomplish more in a shorter period of time. In fact, some people from Tech Shop, which is a national for-profit makerspace franchise, they were saying the other day that what used to take 9 months now takes a weekend in parts of the machining world.
You know, what Nick was also saying, though, was that he is doing this so that he can make a product that has what he sees as a valuable use. And, I don't mean to look askance at anybody doing any of this work, but some people call themselves tinkerers. Some people say, this is just for fun. And so you can see people sometimes saying, okay, so what's the point? You're just creating these things that are kind of fun. It's like adult play, or in some cases you're targeting younger audiences. But is there anything that you're going towards? I mean, are we going to get anything out of the maker movement that then is used to solve problems or becomes new technology or is used as a business incubator?
I think what we're seeing in maker spaces is probably about 30% business related. You know, not everybody is there for just the business purpose. It's like an incubator with tools. It's a whole array of why people are there. You know, it's not just for the business aspect. So they're for, you know, their entertainment, their skill development. They might have a problem they're trying to solve, something they're trying to do it at home or whatever. But it's good to have that space available.
But even some of the stuff that looks like maybe it's play, Doug was talking earlier about the camp for mini makers at the Shelburne Coach Barn, that they're making these sort of wired hoodies. You can see a commercial aspect to that could be used to then create something that people want to buy. So, Jen, are you seeing these become sort of the starting points of new businesses?
Well, I can speak from the experience of teaching, and that I have seen some prototypes come out of my class that I think could have tremendous value in the marketplace. You know, these are early prototypes, so there's a lot of work. You know, you need a lot more than an early prototype. But I think that, you know, the way that we're teaching and this idea of seeing a product from start to finish,
adding in the accessibility to new equipment, nurturing a personal line of inquiry, and that idea of like you can be a problem solver. You know, it can go in a lot of different directions.
We got a note from Stephen who says one of the biggest factors in getting young people to view themselves as creators is to engage them in creative activities as early and as often as possible. As a design technology teacher, I'm continually impressed with how most young people view themselves as adept users and customizers of technology, yet don't have confidence in their ability to create solutions from scratch or out of context. Sadly, this seems most predominant among our most academically advanced students. Many, if not most of our top students excel because they've learned how to play the grade game and have grown quite adept at maintaining a stratospheric grade point average. We often see these students shy away from courses and graded activities that deviate from the traditional and familiar, such as those that involve open-ended design problems. And what we see here in the Maker Movement is really kind of addressing that, Doug, that this is a way to get people to sort of think more creatively.
Yes, yes. It allows them to go into a space or in their classroom or whatever. It's a process. So it's you're looking for the solution. It's not like you have it and then you go build it. In the Maker Movement, failure is an option and it is encouraged. Because that's how you learn.
Yeah, and fast, keep going. In quick recovery, you know, from those failures and learning from it. I would also add that, you know, we find a lot of learners who are really motivated by making something and they don't necessarily haven't had the opportunities to do that. But there are generally people who it's just not their thing. You know, they're not motivated by that finished product.
And that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go to Greg calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Greg. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I'm calling from St. Jay. I'm actually the treasurer of the Foundry Workshop. We're a nonprofit trying to create one of the first rural maker spaces on the East Coast. And I wanted to focus on one point that I thought was kind of missed, which is that Vermont, unlike a lot of other places in the country, is a huge, huge population of skilled and underserved individuals. That in the Northeast Kingdom alone, we have a huge number of machinists, a huge number of manufacturers, and just a huge workforce of people working for industries like NSA and Weidman and Kennametal that all day long they work on these machines, but they have no outlet for creativity on them. And that one of the other things that, you know, in addition to learning and art and new electronics that these makerspaces can do is really provide the creative outlet for these existing skilled people to create something new, build a local industry, build, you know, a business that sustains itself beyond just the foreign money, you know, and employees, and really can become a Vermont business. On the craft side, you have Etsy, where people are selling huge amounts of jewelry that they're making with tools and makerspaces in a lot of cases. But this new economy really can help to revitalize and build a whole area.
Greg, thank you for those examples. Really cool to think about people who maybe work on this kind of machinery and technology day in and day out, but don't have a chance to be creative with it, and finding a space in the Northeast Kingdom for people to have access to that. Thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to Alex, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. I have a comment to add to what you read from Stephen and what Greg just mentioned. I think that one of the great things about the Maker Movement is that by giving people access to flexible and advanced manufacturing techniques, humanity as a whole accesses the creativity of people who otherwise might not be able to experiment with and develop their ideas. I actually had the privilege of being a teaching assistant for one of Jen Carson's courses, and what I saw was that a lot of students who previously weren't confident in experimenting or thought to themselves, oh, I can't make technological things, that's not something I can do, by getting their hands dirty and really accessing the techniques necessary to develop those ideas, they were able to see that come to life. And, you know, that allows them to tap that resource and encourages them to come up with solutions. I think that by crowdsourcing technological innovation in such a way, humanity stands to benefit greatly from the maker movement that accesses the intellectual resources of people across the world who otherwise might not be able to contribute.
Alex, thank you for your comment. Appreciate that. Let's get another one in here while we're talking to people about what they think of the maker movement. Allison is in Ferrisburg. Hi, Allison. You're on the air.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I wanted to give some feedback on the library program. My 10-year-old daughter attended both the Toy Hacker class and the eTextiles class at Shalott Library. And it was a fabulous experience for her. And it was really, she's an interesting kid in the sense that she likes art and design, but she also kind of has an engineering mind. And it was a chance for her to combine those two things. And she came home and she did amazing projects. And the toy hacking in particular gave her the strategies on how to even start that exploration.
Allison, so what did she come home with? What did she actually bring home?
Well, when she went to the class, and there were about 14 kids and only two girls, she had like a Fisher-Price bongo drum set that lit up like a toddler toy. And she deconstructed it, and as she did that, she drew pathways and pictures and circuits and then talked about it with the group and the different ideas, and they all shared their thoughts. And then she started to put it back together again, and she kind of problem-solved, and she realized that a part of it had been damaged permanently, and that she wouldn't be able to repair that, but she was able to identify which part it was. And then she was also able to generate some ideas.
Oh, very cool. Allison, thank you for your call. Thanks for that example, too. What an interesting way to think about, you know, getting a child who's interested in technology and the STEM fields and art involved in this kind of activity. Exactly what Jen Carson was talking about earlier with the STEAM, you know, the STEM plus arts, and getting libraries involved so that young people can really have access to this kind of thing. Doug Webster, I mentioned when introducing you that you're the founder of the Champlain Makers Fair. Can you talk a little bit about what the Maker Fair is?
Yes, a Maker Fair is it's a family event. We hold it down at the Coach Barn, Shelburne Farms Coach Barn. This year it's at October 4 and 5, which is a Saturday and a Sunday. And we do it that way on the weekends because we want families to attend. It's basically exhibits of projects that makers created within the region. And we usually have about 50 or 60 projects. And we run from about 10 to 5 on Saturday, 11 to 4 on Sunday. It's just a great day. You know, we have speakers. We have workshops. We've had soldering workshops. Jen, I think you've run a toy hacking workshop. And anyway, people love it. And, you know, speaking of the ages, I have a 7-year-old son. Last year, he was there with my mother, who was 85, and they were walking around together all day and just having a great time with each other and just as stimulated about the projects, you know, equally stimulated, I guess. So
that's coming up in October, the Champlain Maker Fair. We have a link to all kinds of things up at vpr.net. You can click on Vermont Edition. Doug, you have your finger up.
Yeah, I do. And we have about 2 days for people to register as makers.
Oh, okay. So they need to get on that now.
Go do that now. Yeah, Champlain Maker Fair. .com with an E on the end.
Maker Fair, like ye old fair. Jen Carson, where do you see this going? I mean, you're working at the UVM Fab Lab. You're working with people of all ages. Is this just a fad, or is the maker movement going somewhere?
Well, I think that what's happening in terms of what the maker movement is sparking in Vermont goes deeper than just what the maker movement is, because I think it's tapping into a DIY ethic here that is about the foundation of the state. If you look at agriculture and people who worked on farms, you always, if the machine is broken, you have to fix it. So I think that if anything, maybe it's shedding a new light on a way that we already are, that we already exist as a state, and then giving us some new tools to move forward with it.
Jen Carson is the founder of Vermont Makers, and she's an artist, producer, and instructor at the University of Vermont Fab Lab. Thank you very much, Jen.
Thank you.
Doug Webster is the founder of the Champlain Maker Faire and CMF Incorporated. He's also a technical education consultant for the Vermont Agency of Education. Doug, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to speak with State Representative Sarah Buxton about why she is opening up about her experiences with depression after the death of her friend and mentor, Cheryl Hanna. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The death of well-respected law professor and media analyst Cheryl Hanna has continued to reverberate in the many communities she touched. Her husband, Paul Henning, has been speaking out about his wife's struggle with depression, expressing his desire for more openness about the often debilitating condition and for more people to come forward and bring the topic out of the shadows. State Representative Sarah Buxton was close to Hanna, and her mentor's suicide has hit her hard. Yesterday, Buxton posted a note on her Facebook page disclosing that she, too, has experience with depression. Sarah Buxton joins me now. Thank you so much for being open and for coming on the program, Sarah.
Thank you.
You said in your Facebook post that you've been seeking treatment for depression, but you hadn't wanted to tell anybody outside your very close circle because you feared that it might be detrimental to your career and to your reputation. So despite those concerns, why are you being more open and public about it now?
Well, I think Cheryl's husband, Paul, revealed some very honest reflections about Cheryl's struggle with depression. In particular, her concerns about openly seeking treatment for fear that it would reflect negatively on her career. And that resonated so strongly with me because I, too, worried and still believe that our collective judgment tends to diminish the character or capabilities of those who are openly managing our mental illness.
So do you feel like people may look at you differently? What's your worry?
Yes, I worry that they would look at me differently. I worry that the sort of disclosing this very mystified, you know, condition of mental illness might reflect on my own character and capabilities. And we struggle in this world with, you know, this sense of wellness and this sense of illness. And I don't view myself as being ill because I think particularly with mental health, we're all on some sort of spectrum. And, you know, I really can't control where other people will put me on that spectrum. I can only control, you know, my path.
You can also, I guess, have some control over how you see yourself and how you want to tell people about what you're going through. So what are you saying to people about this?
Well, you know, I'm no expert, and I'm only drawing on my own personal experience. So for me, you know, I had known for quite a while, and I suspect a lot of people who think they may be suffering from some sort of mental illness may kind of know that they need to get help and they experience their own private pain. I talked with my doctor, and my doctor had been urging me to, you know, seek counseling, which in a rural area is really challenging. It's not just an hour out of your day every week, but it's a 45-minute drive either way. So I encourage people to talk with their medical professional, partly because in my experience, Gifford Hospital, which is the hospital that I use, has a person who was able to help me find the right fit with a counselor. So it wasn't just talking with my doctor about, you know, what's the right medication, if any, but it was also understanding what type of treatment I needed and finding a person who would be able to provide what I needed and continue to monitor in a way that I still felt like I was, you know, in control and part of this process.
One of the things that you're talking about here is the acknowledgement that you needed to seek treatment, mm-hmm. and that you did, and in some ways to encourage other people to do that, to find someone. You just mentioned, you know, go to someplace like Gifford where there is a counselor or somebody who can help you find the right counselor. But
right.
Seeking treatment is obviously a huge issue, especially when we're talking about the stigma of depression.
Yes. I've thought a lot about the stigma, both in the past year because of my own experiences, but also in reading what Paul has revealed about
Cheryl's struggle. And, you know, I don't really know how to change this. I know that a person has to feel supported in claiming their time to heal. And that means that employers and friends and family really have to support a person's full access to treatment without judgment. And I consider how, you know, in our world, a lot of health access comes during the workday. And if you're going to access it, you need to either claim a sick hour or you need to sort of disclose to your coworkers or your employer where you're going and why. And that is another barrier that you have to get over. And, you know, perhaps I would say maybe a first step is for employers to consider how open they are about helping their employees to access treatment that they need and not make it so challenging for them to step forward and seek the treatment they need, but really have a flexible policy.
You're also, I understand, concerned about young people and depression, and that certainly is a huge topic. And for many young people, especially those under the age of 18, accessing treatment is not something that they can necessarily do on their own.
That's exactly right. I think about how hard it was for me as a grown adult and an attorney and a state legislator who seemingly has it all together. And I really struggled to be able to say to someone that something isn't right or I'm not well, even though I had a really close circle of folks who can and did support me. But I can only imagine for a teenager that that's just that much harder. And also, frankly, because of my Facebook posting, I've been reading a lot of folks' comments, and one woman wrote very thoughtfully about postpartum depression for women and men. And I know that, you know, there are a lot of places where people often get closed in and don't have ready access to reaching out and finding those resources that they need.
We're talking right now with Sarah Buxton. She's a Tunbridge State Representative, and she's decided to make the decision to be open about her own struggles with depression and to have it be more of an open conversation in the state, partially spurred by the suicide of her mentor, Cheryl Hanna, and Cheryl's husband, Paul Henning, who's been asking for more openness around this subject and more discussion about it. Sarah, I mentioned you posted on your Facebook page yesterday saying, hey, you know, this is me and I'm being open and let's have this conversation. What have you been hearing from people since yesterday?
Wow. I've heard just a remarkable, I mean, hundreds of people who are acknowledging that they have had an experience with depression, either they themselves or someone close to them. You know, it could be depression. It could be mental illness. It could be, you know, a whole range of things. It doesn't have to have a title. But even if it's not diagnosed, I think everyone knows what we're talking about, but we don't have the tools. It's clear to me that we don't have the tools to be able to talk about it. And I would love to see more scientists and doctors and health professionals engaged in a public awareness effort in order to demystify what mental illness is, how it impacts people, and to demonstrate that the value of active treatment is really superior, and perhaps then we can turn our societal view of treatment into something that indicates a person's high character rather than something that is lacking.
So you are a state representative. Is this something that you are thinking you may take action on in Montpelier?
You know, initially, I think with grief, we always want to say, how can I fix this? How can I make sure it doesn't ever happen again? In consultation with my counselor, you know, I expressed that desire, and she advised me very thoughtfully to sit back and just let this play out and let some of the issues really rise to the table so that we can properly define what the problem is. I don't think that means that I'm going to sit back and do nothing. I do plan to really push this issue and see what it is that the state or our available partners and resources can offer to move this forward. I just don't know what that is yet.
Yeah, you're not crafting legislation as we speak.
Right, right. maybe in the car when I'm driving. but yeah, I haven't put in any drafting requests or anything. I'd like to hear more from people and let the conversation advance before we jump to the right solution.
You have said, though, in your Facebook post that you're still concerned that this could have a detrimental impact on you, on your career, on your reputation. Now that you have taken that step to make it very public, are you still worried? What do you think may happen?
Yes, I am worried, and I'm worried not because there's going to be a press story or some accusation that my character is faulty in some way, but I'm worried that there are ways that people in positions of power can use some of the things we don't know about mental illness or preconceived notions of what that means and what that draws on people, and using that adversely against me and others. So I'd love to see more people who are some sort of a public stature acknowledge that perhaps they or someone they know is also struggling with treatment and other forms of experience.
Well, you certainly have done that. Sarah Buxton is a state representative from Tunbridge. She's been speaking about her experience with depression and her decision to go public with it. Thank you for talking about it with us.
Thank you.
That is going to wrap up today's show. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to switch gears here and talk a little bit about fairs. It is fair season. We're going to mingle with the crowds, pet the animals, judge the baked goods. We're going to have a good time. So share your thoughts about fairs with Vermont Edition by going to vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.